In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
It's hard to watch someone you love suffer, like watching what is happening right now in America. But as I've said before, the best way to cure socialism is to actually live under socialism. Because given power, wannabe tyrants will show who they really are and what they'd really do if they really had all the power. And that in itself is a silver lining to what is happening right now. The New World Order types, who long for the days when aristocrats ruled the world and everyone just snapped to and bowed, thought that they could run over us. But they don't understand the power and allure of freedom, that people like freedom. They don't like it being taken away. And they didn't understand America and the genius of its design. The New World Order types know and admire Europe, which is all too prone to authoritarianism. That's why socialism and Marxism keep rearing its ugly head there. Almost all of Europe is designed from a top-down model that protects the state over protecting individuals and their individual rights. It's why places like Austria and Germany, which ought to be all too familiar with tyranny because some people alive today were also alive during the Nazi reign, are instead going right back there, yellow-starring the unvaccinated and locking them down, stripping them of their rights. The whole of society suffers when individual rights are trampled on. America is different. America was founded from the bottom up. The Constitution protects the rights of the people, individual rights. Our highest law of the land does not protect the power of government, but instead government must give way to the power of the individual. As Jonathan Emord said, there are no collective rights in the Constitution, only individual rights. And that's why here in America, there are silver linings. The more Democrats try to destroy the country, the more opportunities there are for Republicans to get their issues out there. Don't like lockdowns? Well, stop electing people who think you have no rights. The silver lining of COVID is that it exposed tyrants. It exposed the problems with the schools, as parents, also home due to COVID lockdowns, got to see and hear just what their kids were being taught. And despite the Democrats' effort to award themselves four or even five of Oregon's six congressional districts, there are some silver linings there too. The more Democrats try to destroy Oregon, the more opportunities there are if we take action. To talk about that end of things, I'd like to welcome back Alex Scarlatos. He ran for Congress in Oregon's CD4 against longtime incumbent Peter DeFazio. CD4 at that time had a slight Republican advantage, so Alex absolutely should have won. But that's the power of incumbency, unfortunately. But forget incumbency. Now we live in a reality where Oregon Democrats throw out all sense of fairness, ignore the law, renege on deals, betray their colleagues, and blatantly redraw maps to favor Democrats, all the while claiming that there's no gerrymandering here. Alex, thanks for joining us again today.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. So let's start with the redistricting issues. What does your map look like now? How has it changed geographically speaking? What areas were added, which areas were removed, and so forth?
So the old 4th Congressional District was pretty much all of southwestern Oregon, all the way up to Benton and Linn County. So what happened now is they moved the entire thing west towards the coast, which it already was on the coast, but we lost Josephine County, we lost Linn County, and in exchange we picked up Lincoln County, as well as we lost the southern half of Douglas as well. So it's moved slightly more Democrat, however, it's still within reach of a Republican, and again, it's still very competitive. I think the Democrats with redistricting almost bit off more than they can chew.
Well, I think you're right, is that it's somewhat more of a disadvantage for Republicans in 2022, I wouldn't count anything out. So speaking of that, how has it changed politically speaking?
Well, politically speaking, I mean, this has kind of been the trend over the last 10 years, to be honest, but the South Coast has continued to go more Republican, which is fantastic. And politically speaking, this year, of course, with Joe Biden's terrible policies, I mean, you've got inflation, you've got the lack of a border, you have the employment crisis, and of course, being an Afghanistan veteran, we can't forget about what he did to Afghanistan and the 13 American soldiers as well. I mean, it seems like he's running this country into the ground on just about every level, everything he touches. And I mean, that's why his and Kamala Harris's approval ratings are in the gutter. And it's scaring a lot of Democrats this cycle. And like I said, with redistricting, I really think Democrats bit off more than they could chew because they really didn't think it was going to be this bad of a year for Democrats. Republicans are leading the generic ballot right now by 9 or 10 points. And what that means is the 5th congressional district in Oregon is only 1 point leaning Democrat. The 6th congressional and the 4th congressional, I think, only lean Democrat by about 4 points. So if the election were today and we had a respectable Republican candidate in all of those races, we should be able to win every single competitive seat in Oregon. That would leave us with 4 Republicans and 2 Democrats with the Oregon congressional delegation. So if that's the case, I mean, I think Democrats really went too far drawing a lot of these districts still Democrat, but within reach of Republicans. And in a year like 2022, that could come around and bite them in the butt. Absolutely.
Well, what's been the reaction of people in CD4 to this drastic redrawing of the map down there?
Well, to be honest, I don't think a lot of people know. The politically informed people know. And I would say that even though they gerrymandered it to keep a lot of Democrats in, it's not quite as terribly gerrymandered as, say, the 5th congressional district that has Portland and Bend in the same district, and it's very hideous. Really, the 4th congressional district now is the coast from Curry to Lincoln County, and with all of Lane County and Benton County. So it makes a little bit more geographic sense, even though it's pretty obvious that they gerrymandered it to keep as many Democrats in it as possible. So, I mean, like I said, I would like to raise awareness on redistricting. I wish we raised awareness on redistricting a year ago when we actually could have done something about it. I mean, I wish House Republicans walked over the map. I mean, I wish we had a ballot measure that could have put redistricting truly to an independent commission. I wish the Democrats didn't lie and kick the Republicans off the redistricting committee. There's a lot of things that we could have done better. However, now the maps are pretty much all but final, so we're going to have to live with this reality. However, again, in a year like 2022, it's definitely within reach a lot of districts, not just ours.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing when you look at the new map. They literally have 4 of the 6 districts touching Portland. I mean, that is some heavy-duty, in-your-face gerrymandering right there. The Democrats make up about 1/3 of the voters, but pretty amazing that 1/3 of the voters get 2/3 of the districts if it goes their way. All right, let's go and take a break. We'll have more with Alex Carlatos coming up after this. Alex Carlatos is a former Oregon National Guardsman, and he ran last year for U.S. Congress in Oregon City 4. That's in the southwest corner of Oregon. He was also in a movie directed by Clint Eastwood about Alec and his friends who stopped a terrorist on a train bound for Paris. And Alec, we've been talking about redistricting. I hate that word. That's really hard to say for me for some reason. But there was a challenge to this plan, which said that the Democrat plan violated the state statute governing this, ORS 188.010, titled Criteria for Apportionment of State into Congressional and Legislative Districts. Paragraph 2 reads this: no district shall be drawn for the purpose of favoring any political party, incumbent, legislator, or other person. So CD4 went from a -1 Democrat disadvantage to a +9 Democrat advantage. I mean, how is that not overtly favoring an incumbent or party?
Actually, a slight correction there. By the end of the race, we had actually changed the PVI of the district to an R+1. So it went from an R+1 to a D+9.
Right.
And I mean, that's a 10-point swing right there only on redistricting. And I mean, it's the real sad thing about it is that people, unfortunately, are not going to be represented equally, not only in the 4th congressional district, but again, the 5th, the 6th, the 1st, and the 3rd. Mm-hmm. All of those go into Portland, like you mentioned. So Portland really controls 4 congressional districts. And like you said, the Democrats, again, control, I guess, 5 of 6. I mean, or should, yeah, based here, on the PPA right, alone, right, theoretically. Mm-hmm. Even though Joe Biden, I think, only got 56% of the vote in Oregon, they get 5 out of 6 congressional districts that lean their way. Again, I think Republicans can win several of those this year, but it's still incredibly unfair. And I mean, I'm against gerrymandering in Republican states as well. I'm against gerrymandering, period. It's, again, it's disgusting and it deprives people of accurate representation. I mean, Peter DeFazio was saying, he was basically calling people in the southern part of his district like wackos or idiots because the rate of unvaccinated people were so high. And when you have a voter base in a different part of the district, you can pretty much ignore everyone else that's in the district instead of representing the entire district or drawing the district fairly in a way that makes sense geographically. And unfortunately, Oregon Democrats did not do that.
No, they certainly did not. So the lawsuit against the obviously gerrymandered Democrat scheme was tossed out this last week by a panel of judges the day before Thanksgiving. The Republicans pushing the lawsuit then gave up rather than take it to the Oregon Supreme Court, which, you know, quite frankly, likely would have ruled for the Democrats anyway, seeing how they're all Democrats appointed by Democrat governors. Could you, as a candidate, though, clearly affected by this, could you file a legal challenge to the redrawn map?
I believe we could. However, there's no guarantee that the Oregon Supreme Court wouldn't draw the map worse for us. So, you know, you never know. And to be honest, I know the 4th is winnable in a year like 2022. We've kind of been dealt this hand. We could try to fight it, but like you mentioned, our odds of winning are not very high. The focus should have been on redistricting last year. Yes. Unfortunately, Republicans do a lot of that. We try to change things after the fact when we should have been proactive about it, and there's a lot of blame to go around on that issue. What we really need to be doing is focusing on redistricting for 2030. Even now, I mean, it's an issue that we need a plan ahead. We need a plan right now on winning these competitive congressional districts. Right now, we need a plan on getting a good governor's candidate through the primary to win the general. We can get a governor. I mean, if we can win a governor, all of these congressional districts should be going Republican as well, because the state of Oregon only leans Democrat by about 6 points, which is what all of these congressional districts are within that margin. So we need to recruit good candidates. We need to get good people through the primaries. We need to donate and volunteer to candidates like myself that are in competitive races, volunteer on their campaigns to door knock. It's going to take a concerted effort. Just because 2022 is going to be a good year for Republicans does not mean we're going to win all of these seats.
That's right. Can't sit back on your laurels, that's for sure.
We are still at a disadvantage in every single one of these districts except for Oregon's second district. It's going to take a lot of work. I mean, just because it's within reach does not mean it's going to happen by accident. It's going to take a concerted effort, and I want all of your listeners to know that and to make sure that they're getting involved in some level.
Well, I think if the legislative Democrats that redrew these maps, if they had to throw DeFazio that big of a bone, going from a +1 Republican to a +9 Democrat, I mean, that's a 10-point swing. They clearly saw you as a threat. So I guess that's something positive to take away from all this.
Well, I'd also say that the Cook PVI, I believe, is only a D+4. So it's a D+9 on the 538, but it's a D+4 on the Cook PVI. So it is a little bit more competitive than it looks at first. But they were definitely playing defense, that's for sure. However, it is a little bit more achievable than people think. I think the 4th and the 6th district are about equal. The 5th should be a little bit more competitive. However, I will say one advantage of running in the 4th for us is that we've run last time, mm-hmm. and that is a huge advantage running a second time.
Yes, it is. So let's say that Alex Skarlatos wins office at the congressional level, and let's say that Alex Skarlatos is appointed to commission to overhaul how districts are redrawn. What changes would you make to ensure actual fairness?
Well, I would say that wherever possible, they should follow county boundaries. I mean, counties are their own little miniature governments in and of themselves. Right. They should not split up between different congressional districts. I think that's the first thing we should do, as well as obviously run an independent commission to actually draw these maps, a real independent commission made up of three Republicans that the Republicans choose and three Democrats that the Democrats choose, or something along those lines. The Republicans shouldn't be picked by a Democrat and vice versa if the Republicans are ever in charge of state politics in Oregon again. Yeah. It should be a truly bipartisan commission that redraws these maps, and they should take county boundaries as the first step in redistricting. And if they have to go from there, that's great, but it should be an independent commission at the least.
Absolutely. Okay, Democrats gave themselves a huge advantage, but lo and behold, a ray of sunshine breaks through the storm clouds. We'll talk about that coming up with Alex Carlatos. And welcome back. We're talking with Alex Carlatos today. We ran last year against DeFazio in CD4 and narrowly lost. Thanks to Democrats who never gerrymandered, that district was redrawn, and Democrats have been given a huge advantage. In one polling, it went from a +1 Republican to a +9 Democrat. So, Alec, though, there's some good news, because on Wednesday, Peter DeFazio announced, seemingly out of the blue, that he was not going to run again in 2022. I mean, the guy's been there forever. Was this a surprise to you and your team, and what did you make of it?
I mean, it was a surprise. I mean, we've been expecting, I think everyone has been expecting DeFazio to retire for about the last 10 years. He's been there longer than any other congressman in Oregon, and he's very extreme for such a moderate district. However, I think what really happened was that he saw the writing on the wall. He saw that we were running again. He saw a tough reelection, and he saw the fact that between Biden's policies and some of the policies that he himself has helped pass, that it's going to be a great year for Republicans, and Democrats have run this country into the ground. And he knew that even if he was able to win re-election, he wasn't going to be the chairman because Republicans were going to take back the House. And so as a result of all of that cumulatively, he just decided to not seek re-election, which, again, is a huge opportunity for us. Not having an incumbent congressman there's going to be whoever we run against on the Democrat side is not going to have the name ID that Peter DeFazio has. They're not going to have the money or the PAC support. And we've already run this race once before. We know what we're doing. We have a great base of support. I mean, honestly, it's fantastic news all across the board.
So in the announcement, Politico said that, quote, his move comes as Democrats are widely expected to lose the majority in the House in 2022. Which is likely to have factored into his decision. I mean, I think that's very telling. You don't up and abandon yacht if you think the other side is going to have just a slim majority. It tells me that they're basically on a suicide mission right now to shove through Biden's DemoCare bill, which will have billions of funding for Democrats and Democrat organizations. So, you know, just take the money and run. What are your thoughts?
I mean, I think that's a pretty fair assessment. I mean, I just think DeFazio, I mean, not only is he getting older, but he knows that if Republicans take back the House, it's not just going to be for 2 years. We're going to win with such a majority that we should be able to keep it for 4 to 6 years. This is going to be a landslide. It's going to be a red wave. But again, we are still in Oregon, and we still need all the help we can get to make sure that this happens. It's not going to be a layup. This race won't be.
No.
The other congressional districts, the governor's race won't be a layup. We need to get coordinated as a group and volunteer and donate and support our candidates. This is going to take a lot of work on our part and a lot of other people's part.
Yeah, I think the governor's race is going to be real key, because you always ride on coattails like that. And if we can get a really strong governor's candidate, that will pull a lot of Republicans across the finish line as well, I think. Although, you know, looking there at DeFazio, as I said, you don't step down if you think it's going to be a narrow loss and you're going to have just a few vote majority there. It just makes you wonder what kind of internal polling they saw. It's got to be drastic.
Well, we'll find out. I mean, we'll do our own polling shortly, or someone else will, I'm sure. But you don't have to be a rocket surgeon to know that it's going to be a tough year for Democrats, and that's the bottom line. I mean, everybody across the country is excited. And, I mean, if we can win that many congressional districts, or at least have that many competitive in a state like Oregon, I mean, it's going to happen all across the country. And I just hope that the National Party is paying attention to Oregon. I know they're paying attention to our race, but there's a lot of other races that they should be paying attention to as well. I just hope that everybody in Oregon, all Republicans, get out to vote. This is going to be a turnout election. If we can turn out more voters than the Democrats, we're going to win, because we know we're going to win some of the unaffiliated or independent voters. We know we're going to win probably every demographic of independents and unaffiliated. So we just need to turn out more than the Democrats, and we'll win almost all of these competitive elections.
Well, you certainly have to pull across a lot of NAVs, the non-affiliated voters, because right now they outnumber Republicans. They're the number two voter bloc. But unfortunately, a lot of those simply don't vote. So you're right. It is going to come down to turnout. So speaking of that, how do you think you win the fourth? Do you have any sense on strategy as to which direction you're going to go now? Maybe do some things this time that maybe you didn't last time. What are your initial thoughts here?
Initially, I mean, we don't exactly have a game plan yet as far as a ground game or things like that. But just judging by our vote totals from last time, we really need Republicans in Coos, Curry, and Douglas to turn out. And then we need to win a lot of the non-affiliated voters in Lane County and Lincoln County and Benton County. That's really what I mean. We need Republicans to turn out across the board to make it competitive. And then need to win the moderates and non-affiliateds to get us over the top. That's really the bottom line. We need to make sure we don't lose Lane County quite as much as we did last time. That's going to be essential. And as long as we can do that, hopefully Douglas, Coos, and Curry will bring it home for us.
How do you attract those moderates and the NAVs to cross that line essentially and come vote for you?
I don't necessarily think we have to motivate them a whole lot. It seems like Joe Biden and the Democrats are just scaring them away from the Democrat Party. We really just have to be the party of common sense. Small government, low taxes, anti-inflation, of course, pro-worker. I mean, there's a lot of things that we can be doing better as a party. And fortunately, we've really been handed a huge opportunity by the Democrats, and we just have to seem like the reasonable ones, and that's really what we're planning on doing. I mean, I'm still a Republican, I'm still a conservative, but we need to run on issues that everyone agrees with if we expect to win competitive races.
Absolutely. So real quick, our next guest is going to be talking about getting real school choice on the ballot here in Oregon. Where do you stand on the issue of school choice?
Oh, absolutely in favor of it. I mean, we saw what an issue that could become in Virginia, and we need to find our own local issues as well to move people on. But that, I mean, school choice should already be a thing. I'm surprised that it's not in most of the country. So we absolutely need to push for that as Republicans and good constitutional conservatives.
Alec, I want to thank you so much for your time. This has been great. Best of luck going forward.
Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
Donna Kreitzberg is a former CPA, business and tax attorney, and real estate broker. She holds a master's in management finance. But retired now, she has turned her attention to improving Oregon schools, and she helped lead the effort to gather enough signatures to put school choice in Oregon across the first finish line to start that process. Donna, it is great to talk to you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So school choice, actual real school choice, where the money would follow the student and parents could choose where to send their kids or even homeschool, and the money would pay for those educational services. I mean, this would be a great prize for Oregon, really for any state. What prompted you personally to get involved with this?
Well, I ran for school board on a platform basically of having activism and politics removed from schools and have the schools focus back on education itself, reading, writing, and arithmetic. I wasn't successful in that, but in the process, I met a lot of wonderful people, and I thought, you know, maybe I should do it in a different manner. Instead of being within the school system, maybe I should do it outside of. And I'd always been thinking that it made sense to just basically say that a child is worth a certain dollar amount and have wherever that child goes, the money go and follow the child. And so I started to think, well, maybe I'm supposed to do that now. Hmm. So I met with some people that helped me on my campaign, and then I researched across the country in the legislation that's either proposed or enacted. I tried to talk to all of the school choice think tank people across the country, Goldwater Institute in Arizona, Institute for Justice in Arizona, a lot of people that write nationally about school choice, and just trying to educate myself on what all the process was, and then basically drafted a constitutional amendment, taking what I thought was the best features of what I saw out there, making sure that ours was truly universal in the sense that it's available to all Oregon families. There won't be a requirement that the family has a special needs child or below an income level or have any specific characteristic. So I wanted it to be available to everyone under the basis of freedom. And then I also wanted it to be available to any type of schooling, because we shouldn't just have it be available to, or I should say, I didn't want to be the one to judge and say, well, only these people should be eligible to use this feature. So we have it available in a public situation and also in the private schooling. So if you want public choice, you can choose within your school district whichever school you would like, regardless of an attendance boundary, and you just have to basically pay the transportation to get your student there. And then in the private schooling situation, it would be available for people to do private school tuition, homeschool curriculum costs, education therapy, tutors, testing, computer transportation. So the money would follow wherever the child actually receives their education. Again, available to everybody under the basis of this should be fair. We should try to allow all students in Oregon the best opportunity to get a good education.
Oh, absolutely. And there are just so many aspects of this that I just truly love. I love the fact that if this was to go through, parents are no longer stuck with the school system that they're at. Geographically speaking, they can take it to another school. Maybe the neighboring district has a better school, more apt for your student. Maybe you want to do a homeschool. Maybe you want to do private school. And I love the fact, too, that the left always likes to talk about equity. Well, here you go. As it is right now, rich people have all of the school choice in the world that they want. They can put their kids anywhere. And now by having the dollars follow the student like this and having the parents make the choice, it really does make it much more equal for that. And so as part of putting this together, did you have to form an organization to do this? How many people did you have involved?
Well, I reached out to the folks that helped me in my campaign. And so there's a core executive committee of myself and three other ladies. We also talked to several constitutional attorneys. I'm a business and tax attorney, so we hired constitutional attorneys. I talked with other people who've put petitions on the ballot before. I've talked with other lawyers. I've talked with lots of legislators here in Oregon and across the country. And what was wonderful is each time I would call somebody and say, hey, I'm in Oregon. I want to bring school choice to Oregon. And they would all stop and just go, wait, what? Oregon? You're kidding. And I'd say, no, Oregon deserves a good education program too.
That's right.
So they were wonderfully helpful and said, I'll help do whatever you need. So we have our core group. We have a lot of other volunteers that have helped us. We have a lot of lawyers and legislators and just ordinary moms, dads, grandparents helping. So it was truly an effort of by the people, for the people.
Yeah.
So that we can basically tap into how do we protect Oregonians. We wanted to basically do it ourselves and be the ones telling the government, hey, this is what's going to happen. This is what we want. This is going to help Oregonians. Because basically the 2021 year has been dubbed either the year of school choice or the year of educational choice. It's like a tsunami washing across the country because people, I think in large part due to COVID, are waking up to the fact that public schools are no longer the solution for all students, and parents want a voice in their child's education. They want a say in the education, and so they want some options. And so in 2021, there have been 21 states that have either enacted legislation, proposed legislation, or expanded their school choice programs. And so it's coming to the West Coast. California has two school choice measures right now gathering signatures to go on the November 22 ballot. Washington will have one to go on the November 23. And we'll have one hopefully to go on the November 24. So it's coming here, and we wanted to get out ahead of the legislature because we wanted it to be for the people, by the people, protecting the people, and not sort of a crush coming down from the legislature.
Well, I definitely love that this is truly a grassroots effort. And I think you're right, is I think so many people are just so frustrated with the school systems right now, and COVID in a large part really exposed a lot of that. You had parents actually watching what was being taught in their classrooms on some of these Zoom meetings and were aghast at some of the things that kids were being told, whether with politics or sex education and some of these other things. You got critical race theory that suddenly is in the forefront. So, yeah, I think this is absolutely the year that is waking people up to the lack of performance in our education system that is supposed to educate kids. And yet here in Oregon, we actually waived the graduation requirements for such things as reading and math. It's just astounding. So you, as part of putting this together, you conducted focus groups and created a survey to gather input on what Oregonians would like to see in school choice. You know what? We're coming up on a break here. Let's actually break a little bit early. We will deal with that in the next segment. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more with Donna Kreitzberg, who is fighting to get real school choice here in Oregon. Stay with us. Welcome back. We're talking today to Donna Kreitzberg. She's a retired CPA, business and tax attorney, and real estate broker, but she is working to put school choice, real honest-to-goodness school choice, on the Oregon ballot for 2024. And so I started to ask you there, you had conducted some focus groups and created a survey to gather input on what Oregonians would actually like to see in the school choice initiative. So what were some of the responses that you got?
Well, based on our focus groups, they were very interested. They didn't know a lot about it. They knew the word school choice or the phrase school choice, but they wanted to find out more, what exactly will it entail? And another thing that came up was homeschool families are very afraid of the possibility of the government regulating them.
Yes.
They're understandably concerned because basically legislatures across the country hate homeschoolers, and they're continually trying to enact legislation to stomp out homeschooling or you know, squish them under their thumb and so forth. And our current legislature, from what the little birdies tell me, has homeschoolers in their sights because due to COVID, a lot of students left public schools. And so one of the main mechanisms that public schools get their money is based on the number of students that are attending. So when the students started leaving because of COVID, that would stop the flow of some money. So the legislature has, you know, sort of licking its chops and wringing its hands and wanting to try to regulate homeschoolers to possibly force homeschoolers back into public school. Well, that's not going to fly, and we're not going to allow that to happen. So one thing that we paid particular care with in our drafting of the constitutional amendment was putting in protections for homeschool families and private schools. We basically put in four layers of protection. One is we actually are amending the Constitution, which is the supreme law in Oregon, and it will allow basically for us to add protections that remain in place so that once the ballot measure passes in November of 24, our protections will supersede any existing laws that attempt to conflict with it, and then it will act as a bar to proposed future legislation that would attempt to conflict. So those protections will be in the Constitution, which is very difficult to amend, and basically be a safeguard for families and private schools. And the protections themselves say that the government may not require parents or private educators to change their creed, curriculum, education practices, or admission policies. Again, because this is by the people, for the people, to say this is what the people want, so government back off, you know, and stay away.
Well, I also like the idea that because of the money follows the student and it goes directly to the parent, once it leaves those state funds and is deposited in the school choice account, they have no say over that. They have no say over how it's spent, and that really removes that extra layer of regulation on them.
Let me just clarify a little bit. So the money does go, if a parent would like a education savings account, we're calling them school choice account, they can raise their hand and opt in, and then the government money is directed into an account that the parent chooses, a nonprofit, to hold. The parent never touches the money so that it's not taxable income to the parent, and we don't have to worry about the parent, you know, absconding with the money on a Caribbean cruise or something. So it goes from the state into an education savings account, and Supreme Courts have held that once the government money goes into that education savings account, it's in essence cleansed of its source of government funds. So it becomes the parent's money effectively as kind of a guardian on behalf of the child.
Yeah,
so it's no longer government money. The government cannot then argue, hey, you took government money, we're going to regulate you. So we put that as a you know, sort of a bulwark, concrete wall that the government can't get over. And then we also added protective language that says that the actions of the parent and education provider are not deemed to be the actions of the government. Again, to tell the government, back off, Jack. We're not going to let you regulate. The actions of the parent are their own. Their decisions of how they spend the money is their own decision. The government may not regulate them because, again, it's not government money and their actions are not attributed to the government.
Right.
So we were really conscious of having this be benefiting and protecting the users of whoever chooses to use the education savings account to fund education in the private world. And they can use those funds then. They direct their nonprofit to pay private school tuition or homeschool curriculum, educational therapy, tutors, testing, uniforms, transportation, computers, software, you know, you name it.
Right. So in terms of the money itself, because that's really at the heart of this, I mean, that's what really gives the School Choice Amendment strength, because the money is in the hands of the parents and goes where the child goes. In terms of the amount of money, I have heard figures that says that Oregon spends roughly $14,000 per child. So talk to us about how much of that would actually follow the child. I know that you've got like a threshold, a minimum threshold of $9,500, but talk to us about how that would fluctuate as well.
Okay, so what we did there is we searched out and tried to understand how the state legislature funds schools and what numbers they use, and it's kind of a quagmire, and we were kind of pulling our hairs out.
Not a surprise.
Difficult to understand. So we just thought, let's just be very transparent and find a very simple way to calculate this. So, we're not changing anything about how the private schools operate. We don't change anything about homeschoolers. We don't change anything about public schools. And in that vein, we also don't change anything about how the legislature budgets and allocates and makes the calculation. So what we did, though, is we analyzed that basically there's the state income tax attributed to education and the property tax attributed to education. That goes effectively in this big pot, and then the legislature stirs it around. And then they carve off about $133 million for carve-out, special assessment, statutory means, reserves, lots of different things. And then they come down to a numerator that they then divide by a weighted average number of students. And to get that, they took the actual student body count, and then they attribute something like 86 different characteristics so that some children are weighted higher based on special needs, low income, pregnancy, a lot of different things. So they take the remaining dollars as the numerator, they divide by the weighted average number of children, and that gets a quotient that's somewhere in the neighborhood for last year of 9537, I think was the number. And so we just said, well, look, that number's going to go up and down depending on how many students are there, what the weighting is, what the budget allocation is, what the carve-offs are. We don't want to change any of that. So whatever that number is, let's say that as a minimum, it'll be $9,500. And it could go then up from that depending on all the different factors.
Sure.
So we're just saying of that quotient, we are allocating 80% to a education savings account on behalf of the parent for the child to be spent in the private schooling world.
Right.
And we are not touching any of the carve-outs, the $133,000, the approximately $750 million of federal money. All of that still stays and goes where it would otherwise go, to whatever public school that would be. And then to the extent that we take any of the money, the 80%, the 20% remains with the public school.
Right.
So we're really only taking a portion of a portion. We're not impoverishing the schools, because basically they say that based on the last 30 years of looking at school choice programs across the country, 84 to 90% of the people that will raise their hand and ask for this on the private side and ask for an education savings account will be what are called switchers, which are students that are leaving the public school and going into the private world.
Yeah, and because of that, I'd actually love to see even the federal dollars get attached to this, so that you'd get much closer to that $14,000. All right, let's go ahead and take a break. Coming up, we'll take a look at what this would all look like. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're on our final segment now here on the iSpy Radio Show. We've been talking with Donna Kreitzberg. She's a retired CPA, business and tax attorney, and real estate broker, but she's working to put real school choice on the Oregon ballot. So real quick, what is the status of this? I know that you guys got it into stage one. What is that, and where does it go from here?
Okay, well, the stage one was we were tasked tasked with getting 1,000 valid Oregon signatures of Oregon voters. And we did that. We got almost 2,000 because we wanted to be safe. We turned those in, and those are now being reviewed by the Secretary of State. We anticipate next week the Secretary of State will say, yes, we passed that threshold. We have enough signatures to get us into phase two. Phase two is where the Secretary of State transfers our petition to the Attorney General. The Attorney General has, I believe, 5 days to draft a ballot title and then publicize that ballot title and let people have comments about it. Then if the ballot title is horrible, we'll submit comments and try to get it cleaned up and actually represent the benefits and protections that this amendment will provide to Oregonians. If we all don't like it, we can appeal it up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court can then look at all the comments and research and make a decision. Hopefully all that process will go smoothly and we'll pop out of that situation this coming spring. We'll start collecting signatures for the big push to get it on the ballot approximately July 10th of 2022.
Well, I like the title School Choice Amendment. I think that's just very elegant in and of itself.
Well, thank you.
You've got four documents that you sent us as preparation for this show, and we're going to put those up on iSpyRadio.com. Just go down the page there for this week and look in the links and information section, and you can find those. And I love this from one of your documents here. It says, introducing competition among all schools will lead to innovation and cost-saving improvements to the content and delivery of education to all Oregon students. And I think that's absolutely correct. Mediocre schools suddenly facing real competition will have to find ways to improve and to attract students and make parents want to put kids there. I am curious, though, have you talked with school administrators or public school teachers? What would they think of this sudden competition?
Well, actually, our chief petitioner for the amendment is Mark Thielman, who's a school superintendent out in LC.
Yep,
and he's been
Mark.
Fabulously helpful because he's already a proponent of public school choice in his own school district. He kept his schools open during COVID. He designed Learn at Home Oregon, which is a blending of online plus teacher interaction for the students. And he's given us a lot of insights on public school funding and how that all works. And basically, you know, I think his words would be that public schools are used to having children bused right to their door where they don't have to worry about funding at all. They just have the kids show up, and, mm-hmm. and so they're not tending to be responsive to the parents' concerns and worries. So if the children are no longer being just bused to them because they're having a choice of going elsewhere, I think the schools will have to look around and say, well, we better actually get on the stick here and be more competitive, understand the concerns of our parents,
Absolutely.
Be responsive
yep.
to the parents, and then, you know, give some of the things that parents are asking for, which is, you know, personal finance education, more trade school situations and training, and staying open and helping the kids with socialization so that we don't face these horrible youth suicide rates
yeah.
that,
yep.
that we were facing during COVID.
And actually teach the basics, you know?
Well, that would be ideal.
That would be awesome. So let's walk people through what this would look like if this would pass. Walk us through the process for parents who this is in effect now. How would they then use this school choice option? What would that look like?
Well, for the public school side, they could choose within their school district whichever school they would like their child to go to. And if there's room at that school, then the school would be admitted and enrolled there. So, for example, if there are five elementary schools and one of them is perhaps really good for arts or English language or whatever, the parent could choose that one. The parent would just then be responsible for transporting the child to the school because we didn't want to monkey with the transportation feature of public schools because, again, we're not changing anything about how public schools operate or private schools operate. We just are trying to get funds to follow the student so the parent can then choose how to customize the child's educational experience. On the private side, the parent can either take the child out of public school, or if the child's already in private school, then the parent can raise their hand and say, I would like to opt in and have an education savings account created for my child. All they do is notify the ODE and say, hey, I've chosen this nonprofit, send the check over there. And then the parent can direct the nonprofit agency to pay XYZ private school some tuition, maybe pay this doctor for educational therapy, hire Mr. Smith for tutoring, get some testing paid for, whatever educational experience and components the parent needs for that child to make sure the child's getting the best education. We're just putting the tools and the finances in the parents' hands so that they, you know, who intimately know and love their child, can customize the education to best serve them. Because the whole goal here is making sure that all Oregon students get the best possible education. We're not against public schools. We're not against private schools. We're just in favor of giving parents the freedom to choose and customize it to help the child, because that's the whole point here. Educate the child.
Absolutely. That is so true. There is a lot more to uncover and talk about, because it would be a true transformation of education here in Oregon, and for the better, but we're going to definitely have to have you back because we're up against the clock. I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you so much. It was fun.
Donna's organization is Education Freedom for Oregon. Their website is still in the process of being built out, but we will link it up on today's show page anyway. That way you can go to it once they're live, which is probably in another week or two. However, their email is live. If you want more information or how you can get involved, send an email to info@k12dollars.com. That's info@k12dollars.com. And just like with their website, we'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com. This week's show has really been a lot about the positives that are out there that are getting overlooked because of the constant storm of bad news. More scaremongering by the media and the administration about yet another new variant that they are trying to leverage into more control, despite it being a less dangerous and less severe strain. Remember, a government that spreads hope is one that wants its people and society to thrive. Fear has always been a tool of the tyrants to control because they want you to obey. That's the lesson from history of every government that spreads fear. It's about control. But there is good news out there, like DeFazio stepping down despite being awarded a huge Democrat registration advantage in his district, parents waking up, and so much more. And in case you missed it, there is also some good news about Oregon's attempt to push through vaccine passports. On November 17th, while everyone was focused on Thanksgiving the next week, Oregon quietly opened for public comment about their digital vaccine records project. The public comment would close on November 30th, less than 14 days of comments with two weekends and a holiday in between. Obviously, they didn't really want your comments. But thanks to some terrific grassroots organizations like Oregon Liberty Coalition and others, they got the word out there, and suddenly, Oregon announced, oh, it wasn't going to be mandatory, it'll be just voluntary for businesses who want to participate. Yeah, like you, I can just imagine the firestorm of public comments they must have gotten, despite trying to keep it hidden from the public. That gives me hope that there are still people, even here in Oregon, who want to and will fight. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.